It feels like it's been 100 years since I've seen you last. Doesn't it seem like it's longer than just last week? I was going to ask Deborah where Southern Rail is this morning. They must have forgotten. I don't know. The time change. They'll be here in an hour. Okay. Thanks, Terry. I'll call them and let them know you said. This morning, I want to begin by praising the transformative power of electricity. The truth be known, I stopped by the Honeydew Donut store this morning for a hot chocolate and was talking to a man right behind me in line who still does not have power at his house here in Sudbury. The electric poles in his neighborhood are down, and they had to get new poles because most had snapped, but he was hopeful. Because right in front of his house, there was a truck parked outside. And that brought him hope. Some of us in Stowe were without power for over 36 hours during this last nor'easter. Some were here in Sudbury were the lucky ones. I asked someone this morning, and they said, well, we were out for about 6 seconds. Some were out for 6 hours. Well, others, as I said, I found out this morning, are still without power. Here in Sudbury and in towns throughout Metro West, the Northeast, and even further away than that. I will admit that this week has been hard, but let's put this into perspective, shall we? There are those who are still waiting for electricity or clean drinking water in Puerto Rico. They have been promised that their power will be restored by May, 8 months after Hurricane Maria hit their shores. Now that is a true state of emergency. How many of you lost power this week? Right? We're all in this together. Can you imagine being without power and clean drinking water for 8 months? 8 months. 36, 48, 72 hours seems kind of doable in the grand scheme of things, right? I was without power, and I have exotic animals like a parrot and some guinea pigs who need it to be 70. And even though it was not all that pleasant being without hot water, I feel that I was pretty lucky because I had water. I had purchased a brand new generator when I bought my home. And with little effort, I was able to pull that sucker out and put it into service. I had purchased cans of gasoline ahead of the storm. I just had this feeling, and I can't even tell you why, but I did. And when I do, I always go with what it says. There was food in my cupboard and plenty of wood stored for the fireplace in my back shed. As the trees were falling all around me, literally, and my neighbors' houses, I went visiting and offered most of what I had to my neighbors. I said, well, it's warm at my house if you're cold. We have electricity if you need to charge your phones or whatever, or have coffee. We have food, we have water, whatever you might need, just come over. We talked about downed trees and the needs that people had, and we wondered how long it would take Hudson Light and Power to restore power to us all in the town. There didn't seem to be any frustration or any hoarding going on from what I could tell. People were even sharing donuts, which I thought was pretty wild. People went out of their way to help one another, and honestly, that made me feel pretty hopeful for Armageddon, the zombie apocalypse. While I was refilling my gas cans at the local gas station, a gentleman walked up to me, and I kind of was like, whoa, whoa. And he asked me questions about running a generator. He needed to go home and start a new one that he had just gotten. He talked about grades of gasoline and what kind of load might be acceptable to place on a new piece of equipment such as this. Apparently, men do ask directions. And from a woman, no less. I was kind of impressed by that whole thing. I must have looked kind of raggedy and smelling like gas. The good news is that no trees fell on my house or on me. All of my neighbors were in good shape as well. We survived the storm. And personally, I felt incredibly lucky because I had the foresight to be adequately prepared, in large part because I had the resources that I needed, much of which come for the generosity of the members and friends of First Parish. And I truly thank you. And I thank you for your generosity to all of the members of this staff. See, the storm and sleeping on the living room floor in front of the fireplace reminded me of what I experienced after Hurricane Katrina. You see, I took a bunch of teens, probably most people's nightmare, I took a bunch of teens down to New Orleans to help clean up and do pastoral care. And after such a tragedy, people know need to show and tell their stories. I saw firsthand how devastating weather and, frankly, incompetence with regard to the upkeep of the levees can affect and devastate people's lives. Parts of New Orleans will never be the same, and I mean that, never, especially those parts where the poor lived. In the face of such devastation, we, the visitors, realized just how lucky and privileged we were, and how compassion and an open heart and mind and willing hands are always welcomed and are considered priceless. We learned that there is no way to monetize a thank you or gratefulness. We learned how tired one could get standing in the muck doing hard manual labor all day, chopping down trees, demolishing water-drenched sheds. And we learned that in doing this work, we received far more than we gave to people who didn't have enough to give, but they offered what they had anyway. I literally saw the remains of people's lives that had been washed away. When I came home to Wellesley to share the experience, I did not have words to explain how I felt. The experience that I had changed the way that I needed to communicate. Gone were the meaningless, ineffectual words. I had to tell the story wrapped in dirt and grime of the real. Here's a fun fact that you might not know. Some might know. In seminary, aspiring ministers are taught that one should never use words like should or the word you in a sermon. I was taught that ministers should never use the word I or me. And we were taught that there are substitutes for words that are a little more acceptable and far less personal. But as you see, I've already said should twice and I a bunch of other times. You see, we're taught that we do not want to make people in our congregations feel uncomfortable. It is true that on occasion I have heard the retort, don't should all over me. I remember those Sundays after experiencing some deeply insightful, transformative moment, and then trying to share it in somewhat a sanitized sermon. It wasn't until sitting in a pew as a student minister I realized that it was those sermons and ministers who dared to get personal that I most resonated with. I started wondering, what is wrong with getting personal? I get that going on and about oneself is self-indulgent, but unless we, each one of us, gets personal, how are we ever going to connect, find, and create connection and meaning with others in our own lives? In my humble opinion, if we don't get personal, we're going nowhere fast. How are we ever going to help one another to uncover what is most important in this life unless we are willing to communicate for real face-to-face? And yes, it can be scary. We are taught to avoid topics. Am I right about this? Politics and religion, to name two. Because we are afraid of difference in opinion with the resulting conflict. And yet conflict is the exact thing that helps us to transform. Isn't that strange? I've often wondered and struggled over and over again how I might possibly deliver a passionate plea without getting too personal. How can I understand another's lack of power, and I mean literal power, unless I'm able to relate it to my own experience of not having power? There is solidarity in the struggle and in sharing our experiences, our desires, our needs. Getting personal enables us to connect and tell our stories so that we can truly empathize and make sense of it all together. I do wonder what humankind is so afraid of and why we're taught to keep quiet. Are we afraid of being seen or of having an opinion? I remember reading or hearing somewhere, maybe when I was a zookeeper, and yes, I was a zookeeper, at one point in my life, to never look into a primate's eyes. Primate authorities explained that looking into the eyes is considered a direct challenge, a threat, so never do it. We are close relatives to primates, so maybe the same applies. In seminary, I remember having a professor who would stare into the eyes of his students for long, uncomfortable moments. I remember how that felt when he captured my gaze. See what I'm saying? It's a little disconcerting at times, and yet it's a connection. So if we're nervous about eye contact, maybe the same is true about language. Instead of using the word you, we choose we instead. Not the royal we, mind you, but more like we believe this or we believe that. We might do this or we might do that. More of we're all in this together kind of collective call. That was my approach last week in my sermon. It helps people feel included but not focused on directly. Maybe you have done something similar with statements such as, I heard from someone or a bunch of someones that they feel this way or that way. Instead of really owning your own opinion, people hide their true feelings and intentions behind anonymity. I believe that there is a rub with this indirect style of interaction. It is very difficult to understand someone who's hiding their true agenda, and it's difficult to be understood and effective if one is not being direct. This gets very real when someone is in need of help, like talking on 911. I think I might be in trouble. I think maybe I'm in trouble here. I don't know. I think that's why police, EMTs, hospital staff, and fire personnel speak directly and at times can seem somewhat terse, right? Because they are breaking down societal norms and language barriers trying to speak plainly. Imagine the challenge when we ministers and other leaders are taught to develop a language of insinuation rather than just saying what it is that we want to say directly. There's a whole code language that is all about beating around the bush and being indirect, which feels somewhat manipulative and passive aggressive. I honestly feel like I'm doing it right now as I set the stage to speak with you plainly, and I'm anxious about it. Because it's hard to speak straightforward without pretense. I feel like I'm literally stalling. Today, after we all struggled mightily this week, what I really want to say is I need you. Wow, that's hard to say. To allow that to hang in the air. I need you. The truth is, it's not just me who needs you. We all need one another to show up repeatedly, to pledge our time, to pledge our treasure. The truth be known, I hate talking about money. I hate it. Nor do I like having to encourage folks to be generous. I feel like the call towards generosity should come from within. But I fear that if I do not talk about need, you may think, wrongly so, that we do not need your renewed or new commitment to support the building, the grounds, the programming, and the staff of this house of hope. There is no religious headquarters on high that sends money to First Parish, unfortunately. The opposite is actually the case. We send money to headquarters. We are a member and a friend-supported organization, plain and simple. You. Y-O-U. Support everything that you see here on this corner, 327 Concord Road. You do this in hope, and you do it to ensure that Sudbury and our world will be a better place. And for many other reasons, I'm sure, as well. The leadership and staff of First Parish needs you. Your care, your generosity, your support, and not in just a little way, but in a big way. The stewardship committee has sent out letters. Maybe you're looking at it or have looked at it. Maybe it's sitting on your counter right now and you're not looking at it. We are planning a potluck, have begun to make phone calls to share their thoughts and engage you in and about your annual commitment. I have so much respect for those folks who serve on the stewardship committee. They're hard to find. Those who fundraise and endeavor to be creative about money. I also appreciate the Board of Trustees who work to make it all happen every single day. I imagine that it is hard to make the canvas calls, to answer the phone when the canvasser is calling and you know, or to meet in person to talk about what First Parish means to you. It might be hard to go to the stewardship dinner, which is a potluck. We are frugal New Englanders through and through. It may be hard to hear about the financial reality of First Parish, the evolving membership, the ever-rising operating costs, the staff's expanding hours to take on more duties to lighten the responsibilities of our members. It's hard to talk about limited resources on a pensioner's salary or family budget, and it's hard to ask you to increase your annual pledge so that you can make ends meet, so that we can make ends meet. But that is exactly what I'm endeavoring and encourage you to do this morning. It's not easy to talk about money. Friends, here's the reality that we face. When we see a storm, clouds on the horizon, and hear the news that we hear all around us about the next impending storm, we should feel the need to prepare, to bolster our reserves, to stock the shelves, to get by gas for the generator. We live in a time when the face of spirituality and communities of faith have changed significantly. People do not realize the need for places such as First Parish to exist. People do not see the importance of meaning-making in their lives, the importance of liturgical music and camaraderie. Religion, CrossFit, Sunday sports compete for time on the marketplace of life. Lots of people want meaning-making only when it comes to times for some life-transforming milestone. Marriage, children, illness, death. In between those milestones, people are busy and other focused. We are chasing a life. We are stoking the fire and filling the generator with petrol. Some of us may be helping others in a myriad of ways. Others of us might try to take time to look beyond the mundane, seeking something more in our lives. This living is not a journey that anyone should take alone. The leadership and staff of First Parish and I am endeavoring to cultivate something truly special here at First Parish. We are compelled to create an environment that is all about seeking beyond the mundane for the jewels hidden within the exchanges in this life. Our planet needs us to go beyond, to strive for peace, and to bend that arc of history towards justice. I need you to seek. I need you to walk with one another, to seek and share with one another, because when you and 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 you seek, you bring wisdom, you bring hope, and you bring peace into this community and into our world. Friends, you may have lost power this week, literally and figuratively, but we are so lucky. We are blessed and we are privileged to be who we are in this time of history. We have so much, and we each have what it takes to create a place of hope, place of transformation for all who seek and find their way here to First Parish. It is not easy to talk about money, but more now than ever, it's exactly what we need to do. Because if we follow the money, we can see how the world runs. And it's not always a pretty picture. And it's our responsibility to cultivate a world that changes that picture. So I want to thank you for your patience and your understanding as you allow me to speak plainly about our gifts, our challenges, our needs, and one another's place in that world of collaboration, co-creation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for your generosity. I invite us to take a few moments in silent reflection and prayer. For this we pray, may it be so. Amen.